Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Burkina Faso's government says the military general who led the recent short-lived coup has sought protection in a foreign embassy. It comes a day after the army opened fire on his supporters and the presidential guard to force them to disarm. In a communique Wednesday, the government said negotiations are underway for General Gilbert Diendéré to give himself up. He told the Associated Press he's willing to turn himself over to face justice. He added that he wants Burkina Faso to resolve its crisis through dialogue. He said he was in Ouagadougou, the capital, but would not say where, and he handed back power on September 23rd to a transitional government. An alleged Islamist radical accused of helping destroy historic buildings in Mali made his first appearance at the International Criminal Court Wednesday. During a brief hearing, Ahmed Al-Faqi Al-Mahdi confirmed his identity but declined to make a statement. ICC prosecutors say Al-Mahdi directed or took part in attacks that demolished nine historic mausoleums and a mosque in the city of Timbuktu during June and July of 2012. Islamist militants took power in most of northern Mali earlier that year. Prosecutors say Al-Mahdi was a member of the Ansar Dine militant group and was an active personality in the occupation of Timbuktu. The Russian Defense Ministry said on Wednesday that the country's air force had begun striking Islamic State militants in Syria, targeting military equipment, communication facilities, and arms depot. Earlier Wednesday, the Russian parliament gave President Vladimir Putin its unanimous backing to launch airstrikes in Syria. However, they sought to downplay that decision. VOA News. NATO said Wednesday its special forces are supporting Afghan troops in Kunduz after Taliban insurgents seized the city, fought off a counterattack, and advanced on the airport to shore up their biggest victory in 14 years. Heavy fighting was underway near the northern city's airport, where government forces retreated, highlighting the challenge the militants pose after their capture of Kunduz. Meanwhile, people living in the city are evacuating after a third day of heavy fighting between government forces and Taliban insurgents. Afghan lawmakers earlier called on President Ashraf Ghani to resign on Wednesday over his government's shameful handling of the battle for Kunduz. Outside the building, but within parliament grounds, female lawmakers gathered to support the call. This is Fatima Aziz. She says, "We don't want to hear lies anymore. The government keeps telling us that we're sending troops, but it's almost 72 hours that people inside the city have been suffering from a lack of food and water and electricity. Children and women are dying inside the city because of hunger. The Afghan army was supposed to be bolstered by its own reinforcements for the campaign to retake Kunduz, but attacks on convoys making their way to the city meant that backup troops were only trickling in." Europe's migrant crisis was set to be in focus at the UN Wednesday, with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon seeking to muster a global response to the exodus of vast numbers of people from Syria and elsewhere. The UN chief opened the General Assembly in New York this week with a call to Europe to do more, as well as appealing to the international community to tackle the source of the problem. An Indian court sentenced five men to death Wednesday for a series of bomb blasts that ripped through packed trains in Mumbai in 2006, killing nearly 200 people. Another seven people were found guilty of involvement in the attacks in India's financial capital and were sentenced to life imprisonment. And all 12 men were convicted of murder, conspiracy, and waging war against the country. Meanwhile, the defense lawyer, Wahab Khan, said all 12 will appeal the verdict. This is defense lawyer Yug Mohit Chowdhury.
The evidence in this case is shoddy, to say the least. It's not fit for conviction, let alone a death sentence.
The bombs were packed into pressure cookers and then placed in bags, as well as hidden under newspapers and umbrellas in the trains. Joaquin, formerly a tropical storm, is now strengthened into the third hurricane of the 2015 Atlantic season. That's according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center Wednesday. Joaquin is now a Category 1 hurricane located about 395 kilometers east-northeast of the central Bahamas, with maximum sustained winds of 120 kilometers per hour. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, first and foremost, speed is of the essence. Many times, even in the best case scenarios, we're seeing that the process of asylum can take between 6 and 18 months. Now, that's an eternity in the life of a child.
That's Sarah Crowe of UNICEF, who says millions of children are suffering in the migrant and refugee crisis. Details coming up.
Also, judges have ordered the French government to seize the financial assets of Denis Sassou Nguesso, the president of the Republic of Congo. And Nigeria's president has taken over the country's oil ministry.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius ruled out a delay in October 18th elections for the Central African Republic, a former French colony. The French news agency says Fabius spoke at the UN General Assembly as interim president Catherine Samba Panza rushed home from New York meetings to try to quell sectarian violence that broke out in Bangui, the capital, several days ago. UN peacekeepers are working to contain the unrest in which an estimated 37 people have died. Fabius praised the role of the interim president, but said popular elections must go forward. The October vote is an attempt to restore democracy after Muslim rebels called Seleka overthrew the government in 2013 and clashed with Christian militias.
Burkina Faso army units loyal to interim president Michel Kafando now occupy the barracks of presidential guard elite. Smoke rose from the barracks this morning as the elite troops fled and their short-lived coup d'etat came to an end. From an undisclosed location and through a local radio station broadcast, the coup's leader, General Gilbert Diendéré, asked followers to lay down their arms. There are unconfirmed reports that the general has sought asylum in the Vatican embassy. Mr. Kafando and members of his cabinet were detained 2 weeks ago, but later released. The coup faced an avalanche of international protest and financial sanctions. The Economic Community of West African States negotiated an end to the conflict. A delay in the October 11th election is being negotiated.
Slovakia is taking legal action at the European Court of Justice against plans to force all member states of the EU to accept a quota system for more than 120,000 migrants. Slovakia is one of four countries opposed to the quota system. In other refugee news, police have forced an undetermined number of migrants from a camp in Ventimiglia near the French border. More than 130,000 migrants have landed in Italy this year. As migrant flows have shifted north, about 19,000 Iraqis have applied for asylum in Finland. Only Germany has welcomed larger numbers.
In related news, the United Nations holds a high-level meeting at 19 UTC to discuss the migrant and refugee crisis. Prior to the meeting, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, has released a new report that says conflicts and instability in five countries have uprooted at least 4.5 million children. Sarah Crowe is UNICEF's Chief of Crisis Communication. From UN headquarters in New York, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about how the migrant and refugee crisis is affecting children.
Children are really at the heart of this crisis. We've seen the heart-rending pictures that have really pulled at the heartstrings of people around the world and really triggered off this deep sense of compassion and solidarity all around Europe as children are on the move. But it's also a reminder, really, of what's happening on the ground in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the neighboring countries that have shouldered the biggest burden of the refugee crisis there. We know already that 2.7 million children, Syrian children, are out of school, and one out of every four of their schools are destroyed. So this is a reason why they are on the move. We should not be surprised that the crisis is what it is right now.
Now, what is the condition of the children? Are you finding them more susceptible to the stress of this crisis?
Well, children always do have an element of resilience. But what we're seeing at every step of the way, whether it's in the refugee camps, in Syria and the neighboring countries, or indeed where the majority of refugees and displaced children are, which means they're in host communities, or children on the move through countries such as Serbia, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and Croatia, and then as they move into Western Europe. And UNICEF is quite unlike many of the other agencies, as we're involved in various levels, you know, whether it's in the industrialized countries with Germany, Austria, and so on, and offering our assistance and our expertise in child protection there, or indeed in a very sort of hands on the ground in the neighboring countries as well as the countries that children are passing through. And what our colleagues are telling us and what they've seen are children are exhausted. They're dehydrated very often because they've been walking a long time. I mean, the majority of them are combining their journey with taxis, buses, some on foot, some on trains, as we've seen. And of course, this means that they have blisters, that they're exhausted, that they're not getting proper food along the way, really, because they're living on canned foods and dried foods. So they're in need of kind of decent hot meals, but they very often do not want to stay in the countries that they're passing through with their families, of course. And we're now looking at 133,000 children between January and July who have sought asylum in Europe. And this, of course, then underlines further how this is hitting children. It's an 80% increase on the numbers of children who sought asylum from last year.
But the children are not just from Syria, are they?
Absolutely not, no. The majority are from Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq, but then there are also some who are coming through from various other parts, such as Eritrea, Somalia. But if we look at the movement of people and children globally, the majority of refugees do go to the countries that are right next to the countries that are in conflict or from which they're fleeing. So that means that Somalis go to Kenya, that people in South Sudan go to Uganda, and it's the generosity of those countries that have, you know, hosted refugees over a long period of time that really is remarkable, and we have to remember that that's how to deal with it, is really by opening their hearts and their homes.
What is UNICEF recommending to do about this?
Well, first and foremost, speed is of the essence. Many times, even in the best case scenarios, we're seeing that the process of asylum can take between 6 and 18 months. Now, that's an eternity in the life of a child. So that needs to be speeded up. You know, the search and rescue operations at sea and on land need to be speeded up. It's important, of course, that we remind all authorities at all times to be guided by the laws and the legal instruments that they already have at their disposal, Convention of the Rights of the Child, the 1951 Refugee Convention, which guides them in the best interests of the child, so that children should never be prosecuted or detained for simply being refugees or migrants. So we're looking forward to some leadership on this issue.
Sarah Crowe is UNICEF's Chief of Crisis Communications from UN headquarters in New York. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Prosecutors in Paris say judges have ordered the French government to seize the financial assets of members of the family of Denis Sassou Nguesso, the president of the Republic of Congo. Reuters reports that the judge's decision is based on lengthy investigations of several African leaders who have deposited assets in French banks. Mr. Sassou Nguesso has served as president for 32 years. The prosecutors call his family's wealth ill-gotten gains. A lawyer for Sassou Nguesso was not available for comment.
Nigeria's president has taken over the country's oil ministry. Nigeria is suffering from dropping oil prices and runaway corruption in the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. President Muhammadu Buhari told Reuters in New York that he has named himself Minister of Petroleum Resources. Mr. Buhari called the extent of corruption in the NNPC mind-boggling.
As Sierra Leone starts the 42-day countdown to being declared Ebola-free, the National Red Cross is using mobile radios to remind people about Ebola prevention. Nina DeVries has more from Freetown.
Isha Wilson-Clark stands outside the Mountain Cut community in the east part of Freetown. She tells residents to avoid body contact of any kind. And remember to always call 117, the emergency hotline, if you're experiencing vomiting, high fever, or other possible Ebola symptoms. What makes this awareness campaign unique is that these skits are broadcast on mobile radios that the Red Cross provides to communities. Wilson Clark takes questions from the audience while people in other communities listen in.
This radio in the box, it is a participatory drama. Not only we act for them, but we need the voice of the people. We communicate with them. We ask them what they understand.
Sierra Leone discharged its last confirmed Ebola case on September 27th. The country must now go 42 days with no cases before the World Health Organization can declare it Ebola free. Broadcasting officer for the Red Cross, Edward Alucius Renner, says the mobile radio project keeps people talking about Ebola so they don't get complacent.
It's something that excites them and wants them to tell their stories. So it's an easy way of getting the stories from the people.
He says the performances teach people that an ambulance does not mean a death sentence. At the peak of the crisis, people saw patients going into ambulances and never coming out, and many are still afraid.
The program, fine. We're all happy for them program there.
Watching the Red Cross performance in Mountain Cut, resident Zainub Kanu says the skit is especially good for parents with young kids like her who may have been reluctant to call 117. The Red Cross plans to expand the program throughout Freetown. Ebola has killed 4,000 people in Sierra Leone and more than 11,000 people across West Africa. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The World Health Organization has issued what are called groundbreaking guidelines for the treatment of HIV/AIDS. The WHO recommends starting ART antiretroviral therapy as soon after infection as possible. The WHO also recommends that PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, be used as a prevention tool for those at substantial risk of acquiring HIV. PrEP is the use of drugs normally used to treat those already infected as a means of avoiding initial infection. Among those praising the new guidelines is Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy organization AVAC. From New York, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
This is an important day. The guideline released this morning by the World Health Organization is what they're calling an early release. I believe the 2015 consolidated guidelines for antiretrovirals for treatment and prevention are due out at the end of the year, but they came out early today with a statement that antiretroviral treatment should be offered to anybody who is infected upon their diagnosis with HIV. And at the same time, they make an incredibly strong and important recommendation that oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, should be offered to individuals at risk of infection. Those are two recommendations that really set the stage for transforming the AIDS response.
Well, let me ask you first about ART, antiretroviral therapy. Why give it the moment you find out that a person has been infected instead of waiting, as they have in the past, for the immune cell count, the CD4 count, to drop a little bit?
Fantastic question, and it's one that has evolved over many years. For over a decade, there have been questions about when to start antiretroviral treatment. And two really important pieces of data have come out over the last couple of years. The first finding was that providing antiretroviral treatment earlier after diagnosis provided a protective benefit, that it reduced the risk of transmitting HIV. Providing treatment early was good prevention. A sister study came out called the START study that was trying to assess when is the best time to start. And they found an overwhelming result that the earlier treatment was started, the better it was for the health of the individual. So we have the powerful message there that treatment is life-saving and better to start early for the individual. So it has the individual benefit, and it has the public health benefit of also reducing the risk of transmitting HIV.
Let's talk about PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. Another way of putting it, I guess, is treatment as prevention. And the WHO is recommending expanded use of this. Tell us about that.
This really is the added piece of the puzzle. And with the PrEP studies, they've been looking particularly at one drug, tenofovir, either alone or in combination with another drug, amphotericin. And the data over the last 5 years have shown us that in very different populations for people at risk, that if you take that particular antiretroviral drug before exposure to HIV, an uninfected individual can reduce his or her chance of becoming infected. The recommendation today that says individuals at substantial risk of HIV, whether they are gay men or other men who have sex with men, whether they are heterosexual men or women at risk, whether they are people who are at risk because they might be injecting drugs, all can benefit from oral PrEP.
The WHO is recommending expanded treatment and prevention options. And of course, this will probably cost more money because you would need more drugs. So do you know how much more money, and in the long run, is it cheaper to treat people now or do prevention now than treat illnesses that may crop up as a result of HIV infection?
While we celebrate and are excited by these guidelines, we also have to recognize that this is a bold and audacious challenge ahead of us. Fundamentally, this would cost more. If we were to offer treatment to the 36 million people who are already infected and provided PrEP to those people at substantial risk, you know, this has not been fully costed, and that needs to happen with urgency from WHO and PEPFAR and the Global Fund. And then we need to understand where can those resources come from and where and how best to spend those resources. But we do know this, that the sooner we prevent and the sooner we treat, the less we will spend in the long run.
That's Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy organization, AVAC, from New York. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, and attention to the disease is getting a boost from U.S. Congress. The bipartisan Congressional Ovarian Cancer Caucus was officially launched in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, September 29th. Its goal is to bring more awareness and research to the deadly disease, which takes the lives of over 14,000 women each year. Two U.S. representatives, Sean Duffy of Wisconsin and Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, came together after both were personally touched by ovarian cancer. Representative DeLauro is a 29-year survivor of ovarian cancer, and Representative Duffy's sister is an ovarian cancer survivor. Duffy also lost a very good friend to the disease. Kalanit Bala is the CEO of the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance. She says the caucus will remind the U.S. Congress of the need for funding.
The Alliance has been working for nearly 18 years now, and with, you know, a lot of champions on the Hill, we've been able to raise about $2.2 billion for research and awareness. But this caucus is going to be really focused on continuing that awareness all year round on the Hill, you know, through members, as well as focusing on increasing some of those appropriations for research and education.
While the survival rate for ovarian cancer has improved, the Ovarian Cancer National Alliance points out there is still no test for early detection, and symptoms are often confused with other diseases, leaving 85% of women diagnosed in a late stage. Over 50% of these women will not live past 5 years of being diagnosed. However, Bala stresses they are starting to see light at the end of the tunnel in the form of genetics.
We've had obviously a huge shift in genetics and starting to understand the genetics of not only how germ mutation or what we would call a natural mutation might put somebody at elevated risk, made famous by Angelina Jolie, whose mother died of ovarian cancer. She had that BRCA gene and, you know, had a prophylactic double mastectomy and an oophorectomy. So that's changing because we have some preventative things that we think we might be able to do.
Bala said they are also starting to understand the genetics of the tumors themselves, which leads to what she describes as precision medicine.
That term meaning if we understand the tumors better, not only in ovarian cancer, but in cancer in general, then we understand what therapies might be more effective than others.
Another big shift has been in treatment, such as IP chemotherapy for ovarian cancer.
That's a very new thing, really only in the last several years, and it's considered a very effective treatment, can be very effective for women who can tolerate it.
One woman who has been keeping a close eye on research and development for ovarian cancer is survivor Clara Frank. We brought you Clara's story earlier in the year. After numerous visits to various doctors for unexplained symptoms, Clara was eventually diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer. She offers this advice to all women.
always be aware of what your body is telling you. Anything that is out of the ordinary needs to be checked by a doctor. In my case, my symptoms were so wide-ranging that you would have had to have been a pretty clever doctor to connect the dots back to ovarian cancer.
Clara's symptoms included intense joint pain. She also had intense gastrointestinal pain, which sent her to a gastroenterologist. Other symptoms were acid reflux, shortness of breath, and most tellingly, an extended abdomen.
I was gaining weight like crazy, but only around my midsection. If you look at pictures of me from that era, that period back in 2013, my face was very, very gaunt, but my abdomen was enormous. I looked like I was pregnant.
Finally, for Clara, the right doctor at the right time examined the skin over her abdomen and was able to make the connection that something was very wrong.
The bloating that one feels with ovarian cancer is not like the once-a-month bloating that women experience. It is a very tight bloating that feels like pregnancy, and the skin is very tight. So by feeling my abdomen, he knew that there was something wrong.
After analyzing the treatment options, which included some very aggressive treatment plans, Clara chose the one that best fit into her busy lifestyle. Instead of getting an initial aggressive simple dose of chemotherapy every 3 weeks, which would leave her very weak and too tired to work, she chose to wear a patch that would administer the medication at a slower rate.
I mean, I was still weak and tired, but I could function. I could come to work. I could walk. I could go shopping. That for me was very important, but that might be an option that may not be available for everyone.
Clara is not just a survivor. She's an advocate of ovarian cancer awareness. She shares information with others through her Cancer Diary blog under DC Media Girl, which can be seen on YouTube. And for Clara and many other ovarian cancer survivors and fighters, the color teal has a special meaning.
We have a lot of activity around that teal color. We have a campaign called Teal is Personal, Teal is Love. I feel like teal has almost become a verb as well as a noun, and people really use it to identify the ovarian cancer community. And that doesn't matter what organization you're a part of in the United States and actually even in other countries.
Early detection is a key to surviving ovarian cancer. And as Clara and other survivors advocate, if you detect something is wrong with your body, see a doctor and don't give up until you get the answers you need. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Judges order the French government to seize the financial assets of Denis Sassou Nguesso, the president of the Republic of Congo. And Nigeria's president has taken over the country's oil ministry. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana and in our feature segment, new global development goals for the Lake Chad Basin. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with an Ivorian football star.
Kim, my latest blog post is titled, Didier Drogba Making an Impact in MLS. And I write about how in the twilight of a great football career, the 37-year-old Drogba is now delighting fans and making a big impact in his inaugural Major League Soccer season. Drogba signed with the Montreal Impact and made his first start for the Canada-based club on September 5th. And talk about sudden impact. Drogba became the first player in MLS history to score a hat trick in their first league start. The still-powerful striker immediately showed his versatility as he recorded a perfect hat trick, scoring one goal with his left foot, one with his right, and one with his head in Montreal's 4-3 victory over the visiting Chicago Fire. In his first six matches for Montreal, the dynamic Drogba has scored seven goals. Our VOA listeners can read my blog post at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Our friend in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, read my Drogba post and had this to say, "Nice one, Sunny. I'm keenly following Didier Drogba's career in MLS. And I featured him at least twice in my weekly Nightline Africa Sports, which our listeners can hear Sundays on the Voice of America." And then Shagun continues, "Together with Obafemi Martins, the Nigerian international who is the highest paid Seattle Sounder in history, Drogba has ignited my interest in MLS." Shagun continues, "Drogba has retired from international football, but I hope Martins can reenact his Sounders FC goal-scoring form when he rejoins the Super Eagles." Magnus Chisholm Onwuadiwe, the humble apostle of the sunny side of sports, who's based in Owerri, Imo State, Nigeria, also read my blog post and responded, "More goals to come from Drogba." Finally, another old friend, the old sports emperor, Barry Mon. Remember him? He checked in after reading my blog post. Barry writes, "Very nice job, Sunny Man. Crisp, cool writing that captures both the spirit and energy of Drogba's majesty. Thanks for sharing."
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station, of course, with partner, the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Joining us once again on the VOA is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, the two big club tournaments, the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup, have reached the semifinal stage. We've had first leg action in both competitions. Let's begin with the Champions League, David. Both semifinal matches played in Omdurman, Sudan. Al-Merrikh 2, TP Mazembe 1. And in the other semifinal, Al-Hilal of Sudan 1, USM Alger of Algeria 2. Your thoughts on those two matches, David?
Well, Sonny, the dreams of an all-Sudanese final are pretty thin at the moment because Marek have got a very slender lead and they've conceded a home goal. And I'm afraid, despite the fact that Al-Hilal's coach says they're still in with a good chance, I will have to respectfully disagree. When you lose at home in the first leg, Sonny, and you concede two goals, your chances are very slim. Let's look at Al-Merrikh first. They went into their game against TP Mazembe very confident. Their coach, Diego Garzito, he coached Mazembe to the Champions League crown 5 years ago, and he really was looking to put one over Mazembe. He was talking about a 1-2 or 3-goal victory. What he didn't say, but I'm sure he had in the back of his mind, was we mustn't concede a home goal. Well, it all started well for Marek. Late in the first half, Kofi, a Ghanaian, put them ahead. But perhaps the crucial moment of the first leg, Sonny, came after 77 minutes when the Tanzanian Thomas Ulimwengu equalized from Mazembe. And I think we all know when you're playing in the African club competitions and it's a tight, close contest, those away goals can be potentially crucial. To the credit of Marek, they came back through their star player, Babacar. He's also known as Al Medina, and he scored after 80 minutes. So it's a 2-1 victory. So essentially, Sonny, Marek have got to go to Lubumbashi this weekend and force a draw. On the other hand, Mazembe know that if they win 1-0 at home, they will go through on the away goals rule. So an intriguing tie. I suspect Mazembe must be slight favourites to go through to the final. Recalling, of course, that a couple of weeks ago, when Mazembe played their last group game at home in Lubumbashi, they destroyed the Moroccans, Maghreb Tetouan, by 5-0. I certainly do not envisage such a one-sided scoreline, but Mazembe at home, very strong, and Marek must have wished that they won 2-0, or at the very least 1-0. But unfortunately, it was 2-1, and that away goal could yet come back to haunt them. Al-Hilal, 24 hours later, they made a dream start against USM Alger. El Taib, their star striker, scoring after just 2 minutes. It doesn't get much better than that. But USM came back. Awadia equalized after 17 minutes. Then Hilal missed a second-half penalty. And just after that, Vitesh scored for USM. So they've got a 2-1 advantage. Sonny, there have been cases of clubs coming from a home defeat, but they're very rare in the CAF Champions League. And I'm going to predict with a pretty reasonable amount of confidence that USM Alger will go through. If you think about it, they just need to draw at home in the second leg, also this coming weekend, to make it to the final. On Saturday, it's USM Alger against Al-Hilal. That match will be played in Algiers, the capital of Algeria. And then 24 hours later, on the Sunday, in Lubumbashi, in the south of Congo, DRC, it'll be Mazembe against Al-Merrikh. I said before the semifinals, I thought it would be Mazembe-USM final, and I guess those results have not forced me to change my mind. And that's interesting, Sonny, because then, for the second consecutive year, we would have an Algeria Democratic Republic of Congo final. Last season, of course, it was Anton Sétif against V-Club, and Sétif won that final over two legs on the away goals rule, so an interesting situation there. Mazembe got to the semi-finals last year, so they'll be absolutely desperate to go at least one step forward and make it to the final. Remembering, of course, that these teams are playing for a lot. The winners of the CAF Champions League receive $1.5 million American dollars, And they also get an invitation to the FIFA Club World Cup, which will be staged in Japan during December.
Lot to play for, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. And David will be back on Thursday's Sunny Side of Sports for a look at the CAF Confederation Cup tournament.
Voice of America!
In National Basketball Association news, Chicago Bulls star Derrick Rose will have surgery on his left eye today, Wednesday, after being elbowed in the face. Rose, the NBA's most valuable player in 2011, suffered an orbital fracture on Chicago's first day of practice. It's the latest in a long line of injuries for Rose, and it comes just a few days after his Bulls teammate Mike Dunleavy Jr. had back surgery. Dunleavy is expected to be sidelined up to 10 weeks. His father was a longtime NBA player and former NBA head coach. Speaking of injuries, South Africa rugby captain John de Villiers arrived home Tuesday and is due to have surgery on the broken jaw that has ruled him out of the World Cup and ended his international career. The 34-year-old de Villiers broke his jaw for the second time in 2 months in South Africa's 46-6 victory over Samoa on Saturday. He then announced his retirement from Test rugby after 107 international appearances. De Villiers returned to a hero's welcome in Cape Town, where about 100 flag-waving boys from his former school and a scrum of media and well-wishers greeted him at the airport. South Africa, a two-time Rugby World Champion, will next play Scotland on Saturday in Newcastle, England. In results Tuesday, Namibia lost to Tonga 35-21 in Exeter, England. It was the second consecutive loss for the Namibians. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the World Health Organization's report on snake bites. And next, new global development goals for the Lake Chad Basin. But first, some music. Here is Rocky Dawuni from Ghana with the Master Plan.
Outside the gates, love will lead us a different new way. Dance and let go of carry each other. Come on, people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Come on, people, meditate, go higher. Ghana people, make you take it, go higher. Come Africa, make you light my fire. And I'll be proud. I could not believe the news today. Another hero falls in South Africa. Wipe your tears and fears away. All you children from Africa, Jamaica, sing new songs of joy and redemption. Wave your flags in celebration. Come on, people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now.
Rocky Dauni from Ghana with the master plan.
Well, the World Health Organization says about 100,000 people die each year from snake bites, about 30,000 in sub-Saharan Africa. Another 8,000 people on the continent are left permanently disabled. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, says that number could soon increase. That's because stocks of a very reliable antidote expire next year and a replacement may not be produced in time. South Sudan In Focus reporter Ayen Bior explains.
MSF says Favafric is the only treatment that has been proven safe and effective to treat snake bites in sub-Saharan Africa. But the aid agency is sounding the alarm that as of June 2016, stocks of the antivenom may no longer be available. Gabriel Alkaba is MSF's advisor for neglected tropical diseases. He says next year's expiration date has triggered an emergency, especially in places like Agok in South Sudan, where MSF treats about 300 people each year for snake bites.
This is a problem that we've tried to avoid for the past years. In fact, we are really facing a high number of victims. Before, it was a neglected tropical problem. Now it's a neglected tropical problem with many victims. And we really think that we will face more because we are discovering that there are many victims in remote areas like in South Sudan, Central African Republic, where we work.
There are 600 different types of venomous snake around the world and all produce different symptoms. MSF says Favafric is unique because it is the only antivenom for use in developing countries that can stop the effects of multiple types of venom simultaneously. Alkaba says this is crucial because most people who get bitten by a snake are unable to identify it.
It covers 10 species of snakes, and it neutralizes the venoms of many snakes, and you can put them in the families of cobras, mambas, and vipers. Most vipers do either cytotoxic or hemorrhagic damage. That means tissue destruction or bleeding. And the cobras, some of them just do tissue destruction, others are neurotoxic. That means that they go to the brain and they paralyze you. And the mambas are like that as well. The mambas are neurotoxic.
Sanofi Pasteur, the pharmaceutical company which produces Favafric, halted production in 2014. It said it was not able to match the lower production cost of its competitors. Spokesman Alan Bernal says since suspending production, the company has been exploring options for partnering with other producers. If so, it could make it possible to resume production. However, MSF warns it may not come soon enough. Gabriel Alkaba says production of a reliable treatment like Favafric is complex and could take up to 2 years to produce more batches. It's also very expensive.
The full treatment costs easily between $250 and $500 US dollars. So you can imagine it's very difficult already to get it into the field and to have it in the right place at the right moment for the right patient.
For example, The viper is one of the most dangerous snakes in the world, killing about 10% of the people it bites. That mortality rate drops to less than 0.5% when Fava-Freak is given to its victims. Alcaba says there are other options of antivenoms out there, but they do not have the same guarantee of Fava-Freak.
South Sudan, for instance, it's really the best option that we have because, I mean, scientifically it has gone through all the tests. I mean, all the safety, security, efficacy studies have been performed, and we've been using it for years, so we have a kind of guarantee of safety and efficacy. And then other options either are of very good quality but don't target the same 10 snakes, or we have an uncertainty on their quality, even if they cover theoretically the 10 snakes, but we don't have the same guarantee.
MSF says most of the victims of snake bites live in rural areas with no easy access to hospitals. So the actual number of people bitten and the number of people who die may be much higher than officials estimate. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
The Lake Chad Basin is considered to be an area in crisis. Attacks by Boko Haram terrorists have uprooted more than 2 million. The region is already facing drought, high malnutrition, and other humanitarian challenges. Stephen O'Brien is the UN humanitarian coordinator. He recently chaired a high-level meeting to show solidarity with Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, the four affected countries. UN Radio's Isabelle Dupuy asked him about the origins of the crisis and whether new global development goals will have an impact.
The humanitarian situation in the Lake Chad Basin, which is a part of the overall Sahel, is characterized by having humanitarian need, and this is endemic and it's on an annual basis. It has now been desperately exacerbated by the vicious attacks by Boko Haram, which has had a major effect on the populations in northeast Nigeria, in Cameroon, in Chad, and in Niger, countries which are economically perhaps very variable, but nonetheless finding it difficult, according to that region, to resist that. But it is staggering that the people who have the least are also showing the most resilience. But the attacks upon their ability to cope have now reached such proportions that if the international community doesn't step up, take notice, and really support the humanitarian needs of the people in the Lake Chad Basin region, then this will move from being purely a regional catastrophe to something much wider. We do not want that to happen.
So what has the UN been able to do so far, and what are some of the challenges it has encountered on the ground?
Well, the UN and its agencies and many international and national NGOs are all working very hard. The funding is in the region of the 40%, and we are now in September for the 2015 appeals in all four countries. So we're a long way behind where we need to be in terms of marshalling the resources. But most importantly, it's what those resources buy. They buy life-saving, they buy protection of civilians, they buy the ability for people to have hope, which at the moment, with people having to rush across the border, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of people, total displacement of 1.4 million people in countries where they have very little resilience and that the host communities are being so generous. But it's using up all their resilience to be able to sow the seeds for next year, to have the capacity to repel the attacks when Boko Haram seeks to send forth its terrible violence out from its heartland. And so we need to recognize that together, and very much backing the countries of the region's strategy to look at the security and the humanitarian needs as a holistic approach, quite right to do that, we need to make sure the international community gives them the added capacity to be sufficient to the challenge.
The member states have just adopted the Sustainable Development Goals, a new development program. Can such an initiative have a direct impact on the ground?
Well, I believe it can. It is a very remarkable thing for the world to come together and to, by a vote, decide unanimously we must go for these global goals, the Sustainable Development Goals. And they will have an effect because they really do put a clear expectation, a sense of real rallying of the world's political and financial intent behind getting social justice, getting peace, getting the food and the water, the sanitation, the education, the medical into the communities where there is most need, where they are most vulnerable. After all, these are all our fellow human beings, men and women, boys and girls. It is up to us to find ways of making sure that they have at least as much hope for a better life in the future as each and every one of us might expect for ourselves. And it is simply unacceptable that we let any crisis in the world go either forgotten or unnoticed.
UN Humanitarian Coordinator Stephen O'Brien, he spoke with UN Radio's Isabelle Dupuis in New York. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Economic disparity, often in combination with other factors, can open the door to violent extremism. Across many parts of the Middle East and North Africa, economic policies have led to the creation of parallel but deeply polarized economies, said U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli. One is formal and often extends the full range of society's benefits to a relatively small and privileged group, but exacerbates perceptions of unfairness. The other economy is informal, marked by insecurity and characterized by low pay and little hope for a better future. According to the World Bank, the typical country in the Middle East and North Africa produces about 27% of its GDP in the informal economy and employs 67% of its labor force informally. In many countries, it is almost impossible for an individual to move from the informal sector to the formal sector, said Undersecretary Novelli. Women, she said, participate in the Middle East's workforce at the world's lowest rate. Many women, when they can't find jobs in the formal sector, become discouraged over time and end up dropping out of the labor force. ISIL has exploited these frustrations in its recruitment efforts by promising women valued positions in their state, and hundreds of women have fallen prey to this narrative. It is important to note that ISIL wants to cast blame on capitalism, or modernity, for creating many of these inequities. In the Middle East and North Africa, ISIL presents a false choice between the unjust status quo and a romanticized version of a 7th-century economy. The most effective way to confront these challenges is for countries to pursue sound market economy principles, embrace transparency and the rule of law, and ensure that all people have the opportunity to succeed. Embracing such reforms can go a long way toward blunting the message of violent extremists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all. on VOA Africa.